Your home for sports on the radio. We are 95.3 The Score. And now,
check this out.
It's crunch time with Steve Tannen.
They think he's a righteous dude.
When I win.
Live from the Papa John's studio.
Wait a minute. Let me get CB on the line. We're green lighting it. It's a go.
And I want full air support. I want tank and some fire thrower. And I want explosions over here. And I want planes going. Cool.
Are they going to bust in here and arrest us?
It's crunch time on 95.3 The Score.
Well, hello. And we welcome you to crunch time. 95.3 The Score. Tis the Tuesday edition of the big program. As we signed off yesterday, we were talking about what had gone down in stores with an historic victory by the University of Oregon women's team, who spanked UConn by 18 points. It's really resonated nationally. Just before we signed on, we were watching the end of Wilbon and Kornheiser. In a part in the interruption, and they were debating bigger win for Oregon, bigger loss for UConn. And hey, that's PTI. That's a heavily viewed show. Sabrina was on with Scott Van Pelt. She was on SportsCenter. Obviously, ESPN with the game. I mean, it was big stuff. Blazers get back to work tonight. They're playing at Denver, 6 o'clock tip. With this recent insane run of scoring and productivity, I'm hearing some more local talk about Damian Lillard as a potential league MVP. I'll get to that in a little bit. Hint, don't hold your breath as what? Things stand. We've also got, I love in the paper today. And by the way, I am still a newspaper guy. But I was looking at, like, when they say whose birthday it is today and all that.
It's not my
birthday. There's any birthday party for me here. You happy with yourself, by the way?
Tannenism.
I don't think anybody today was younger than, like, 77. And they wonder why. Or maybe they're like, we're in the newspaper business. We sure as hell ain't targeting millennials or most even Gen Xers. So, who knows? But they did the best and the worst of the Super Bowl ads. And I think we hit on the best ones yesterday. The Boston-affiliated Pack the Cast, Matt Pack, was good. Groundhog Day, the Redux from 1993 with... Brian Doyle Murray, Bill Murray, and Ned the Head, Ned Ryerson, Bing again. Stephen Tobolowsky, who's in a lot of stuff. That guy, I didn't know his name till I read it in the article. But there was a great special on either HBO or Showtime some years ago called The Guy Who Was In That Thing. And it was just... Every actor they pulled up, oh, I know him. He was in that NCIS. He was in that Law & Order. Oh, he played the judge in that movie. You have no idea what his name is. But I think it was about five of them. And all of a sudden, I said to my wife, you know what the most interesting thing about every one of these guys? They're interviewing him at their house, and it's like a beach house in Malibu. It's like a multi-million dollar. So while they're not getting the Brad Pitt $27 million role, they're getting four roles like every year at like $3.7 million. And
residuals, baby.
Yeah, it was really well done. And I could have named every single person, at least a TV show and a movie I saw them in, had no idea who they were, and they're like wealthy multimillionaires living the California lifestyle. That dude who played Ned Ryerson, I mean, he was the evil clothing producer from single white female. He was in Californication. I mean, he's just been in one after another. Oh, he's the principal in the Goldbergs on ABC.
Which, by the way, if you're going to be the guy who, like, has to get the 3 to 5 roles a year but then live on residual checks, living the Southern California lifestyle is the way to go. You don't have to worry about traveling to Hollywood all the time. You can just say, I'm always around. I've always got a spot. I'm always here for you if you need me. I can play a nice guy. I can go dark. I can play a cop. I can play a criminal. If you need me, I'm
judge,
I'm here.
Defendant. I could be the one who gets pushed off a building in scene 3.
Oh,
I'm good.
Yeah.
And there
Love
was
a building fall.
There was another show. This is going back like 15 years ago. Michael Caine was in it, and they were interviewing well-known actors and actresses who'd made some of the worst movies ever. And I don't know which movie it was. It wasn't Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. I guess that was okay. They asked Michael Caine, you know, why would you agree to do a movie like that? And he went like this with his arms up and looked around. He was like, yeah, I bought this beach house after I made that complete piece of poop. And so it's like, oh, okay. You know, a lot of actors and actresses, they also take on the producer roles and try to make films. So even though they act in it, it depends. Like, I think what made Tom Hanks is he decided to roll the dice and instead of salary, take a piece of a movie that some were skeptical about called Forrest Gump. And that made him from just a real big actor from the late 80s to the 90s to a guy who, like, kind of became on a level with, like, Spielberg making movies. Forrest Gump. I was running.
Is that the ping pong movie?
Yeah, there it was. The movie that moved a bunch of red ping pong paddles. All right, so
or is it a football movie? Or is it a track and field movie?
It's a running movie.
I was running. Is it a shrimp
That's
movie?
An interesting one. Would it be sci-fi, comedy, dramedy?
It's not sci-fi. It's not science fiction.
I can't call it science fiction, even though they did a lot of computer-generated stuff to make it look like he was actually on with John Lennon talking to Dick Cavett. And
that's just CGI.
I don't know why I said sci-fi.
This movie's got graphics. It's a science fiction novel.
Science fiction. Actually, how could you find out what genre a particular movie is?
You could probably Google it.
No, I'm just saying normally, like when, like if you're watching it for the 8 millionth time on Xfinity, you could hit guide and info and it'll say dramedy, comedy, blah, 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 whatever the hell it actually was. Because there's obviously a lot of humorous parts, but obviously a lot of tugging at the heartstrings. I mean, you know, mom dies. That's not always a knee slapper.
Forrest Gump is a 1994 American comedy drama.
There you go. Probably what I'd have gone for. As far as the Oregon win at Storrs last night, we're going double-barreled. My conversation at 4:30 with Michelle Vopel, who does a terrific job covering the women's game for a lot of years now for ESPN. She was there. Kelly Graves, he was also there. He'll join us at 5:10. We'll have a What Are You Doing at 3:45 to wrap this hour. We'll take a look at the overall picture in the Pac-12 for the men and women. Got some football notes. How about D'Antonio stepping down as the coach of Michigan State? You know, normally you'd be like, well, you can't really make much of a connection between Oregon and Michigan State, except that was the big non-con that really provided the springboard to Mariota's Heisman year and them jacked all the way up in the rankings. Then they played him with Big Play VA in 2015. So he's out of the contest, and They made the playoff once, right? If memory serves correctly. Was it 2015? Was it the year they ended up beating Oregon? Yeah, it didn't go well. And I remember, I forgot what year it was, where I was like, I was looking at the standings, and I said, I have a feeling Michigan State is a little overrated. And I ran into one of these guys who assumes anybody who does radio in Eugene is paid and working for the University of Oregon. And everything I said, he turned back around towards, well, the Ducks. I'm like, I'm not talking about Oregon. I actually understand Michigan State. I'm talking about their depth chart, their schedule, their players. What Yeah, but you just are sitting. And he wouldn't give in. I think he might have been one of like the five people I ever blocked on Twitter. I mean, literally one of the biggest jackasses I've ever come across in my life. And I'm on Twitter. So that's a statement. Statement, statement, statement. So got that going for you, which is nice. So yeah, that's when they went 12-1 during the regular season, won the Big Ten, and like Nick said, got shut out by Alabama, Greenbow, Alabama, with
Tannenism.
That's Forrest Gumpism. I mean, come on.
No, I know, but it's almost like every other when you say Alabama, it's going one of two ways. You're either going Alabama,
yep,
or you say Greensboro, Alabama. It's those are the only two ways you can say Alabama.
I've got a confession here. A couple people have asked about the, and it came up yesterday, where Sam Elliott lived, and he's from Brownsville, and he's lives in Oregon, and went to University of Oregon. I don't remember seeing his commercial. So I got to plead ignorance here.
It was a Doritos
Cool Ranch.
Yeah, Doritos commercial. I think Sam Elliott was trying to do some sort of dance-off on behalf of the Red Doritos, which are your classic nacho cheese. And then Lil Nas X had his hit Old Town Road playing and was dance-offing on behalf of Cool Ranch Doritos, or your blue Doritos, if you will. And Sam Elliott had this thing with his mustache where it did like the pop and lock arm wave thing that I'm very glad nobody could see me do, because I think it was about the most white person thing I could ever do in my life. But that was very cool, and they had like a horse do some little like dressage dancing. It was a cool commercial. Also, I said dressage.
It rated out very well. You're doing very well. And the Cheetos commercial that spoofed MC Hammer, because no matter what they asked him to do, he couldn't touch it.
Yeah.
Because his hands were all dirty and orange and stuff like that.
How far would you actually take that? Like, if that actually did work one time, where you're like, I have a snack, here's a bunch of, like, if it worked the first time like it did in the commercial, where ad nauseam, boss comes by, stack of paper, one of you two is getting it. That guy's got orange stuff all over his fingers. We can't have orange stuff on everything. First of all, I'm eating Doritos at work every single day for the rest of the just forever. As long as I work there, until they fire me for realizing I'm not doing any work and I'm spending all
their
money on Cheetos. That would work perfectly. I definitely wouldn't hand a child to somebody that had dirty fingers, especially somebody that's that committed to having their hands dirty to not do any work. Moving a couch, though, at that point, it's kind of like, dude, just help. Like, it's going to be on the underside of the couch. It's probably very old. It was probably picked up off the street, if not somebody had done gross things to it already. You can touch the couch with your dirty Cheeto fingers.
All right, if you insist.
I do.
All right, 284-8571, the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. If you want to jump on in, you can feel free. You can text us, 321-0824, or you could also try us on Twitter at 953thescore for the station, at SportsTalk 953 for the show. For Nick, it is at Rick Nodger. So as for the Uber Bowl, so that game, which of course took on a different angle of drama in that fourth quarter, I guess I hadn't even realized, because when they talk about declining viewership for football or sports in general, it's like, duh. People don't just watch the games on TV like they normally have in the past. There's various devices. They're streaming. So there had been a decline in viewership. Almost 100 million people watched that KC rally. Up slightly from the 98.5 million who watched in 2019. So I guess the last time it peaked, wow, 114.4 million people watched when New England beat Seattle on the ill-fated final play, or next to last play. Fox is saying about 102 million viewers in total. They're talking about those who stream through Verizon or watched on Fox Deportes. The halftime performance of J-Lo and Shakira, which, how about that? 103, as many people watched halftime show as the game itself. And, well, this is kind of, you know, I always wonder about this. And when you do pregame shows and stuff like that, they talked about the Fox show that came on after, The Masked Singer, said 23.7 million people watched it. I'm wondering what percentage of those people just left the TV on and, you know, went about their business and just like, all right, we're going to eat more, we're going to shoot pool, we're going to throw some darts, we're going to goof around, we're going to have some more drinks, we're going to socialize. I mean, I'd like to know the percentage. There's no way to ever know. Would like to, you know, what percentage of those were actually sitting down and watching it?
I would like to see the drop-off in the numbers in, like, the San Francisco Bay Area and then Kansas City, the greater Kansas City, St. Louis, Kansas area of, like, the ratings for The Masked Singer in that event. Like, everybody in the Bay Area was just like, ah, we lost, damn, this sucks, go to hell, turn off the TV, turn off the lights, go to bed mad. And then everybody in Kansas City was so excited, they forgot to turn their TVs off, and they go outside to light off their fireworks and bang pots and pans in the street and everything like that and go crazy. And then it's like, wow, The Masked Singer had a great day because every TV in Missouri was watching the Chiefs game, and then they just kept it on after.
You know, you also you wonder how many people just you know, do a little too much partying, and by the time the game is over, they're like crashed out on the couch, and whatever was on Fox the rest of the night counted them as a viewer. By the way, I know we've been kind of tracking it as NHL fans, but Ovechkin scored again last night. So in the past 2 weeks, he's passed Mario Lemieux, the captain, Steve Yzerman, and last night he passed Marc Messier. He's eighth all-time on the goal list. And as you might imagine,
number eight,
everybody ahead of him from Mike Gartner. Well, now the next is join the 700 Club, and then you pass Gartner. The rest of this year, 20 goals sound about reasonable. Maybe not that much. That's almost, there's 15 goals gets him to just behind Phil Esposito, where it's only Gretzky, Howe, Yager, Hull, and Dion who will have scored more than eight. All right, 284-8571, the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. Let's bring in Chris. Chris, good afternoon. How's it going?
Good, Steve. How are you?
All right, what's up?
So, two things. As a diehard Chiefs fan, didn't get overly excited about the win, just kind of more in disbelief, like we just won the Super Bowl. Second thing, about the Cheetos commercial.
Yeah.
We have a three-week-old baby, and so as soon as that commercial came on, me and my wife looked at each other and said, yep, nope, I'm getting some Cheetos. Can't touch this. Nope. So, it was a good excuse to get out of a dirty diaper.
Okay, nice. Avoid the dirty diapers at all costs.
Can't touch it.
Take it easy. Thanks, Chris. By the way, I like the fact that the story that came out today. So the lone baseball writer who didn't vote Jeter into the Hall of Fame has decided he's going to keep his ballot private. And It cracks me up because I mentioned something on Twitter, and I get the people trying to make the case against Jeter, which is fine. But that's not what I was... There's nothing better than making a point and somebody disagreeing with a completely different point. I'm like, if you feel like, well, if Mays didn't get in and, you know, you were a believer that because of that you didn't want him to be a first ballot Hall of Famer... Yeah, Derek Jeter's not the greatest baseball player ever. So instead of being a sniveling coward and hiding, come out and make your case. But nope, some of you just live. No, I'm going to die just for spite. I will be contrarian if it means my demise because I cannot agree with anyone or anything. This is why no one likes me and I have no friends and it's my fifth divorce.
I got a lot of problems with you people.
But it's you. It's all of you. It's never me. When do you first learn common denominators? That sounds like algebra and stuff like that.
I feel that's an
important lesson.
It's not algebra, but when you start adding fractions, I feel like it's in like maybe fifth, sixth grade. Like you start dealing with them, and you're trying to add them up, and they're not doing anything crazy, like add a third to an eighth or whatever.
Two thirds and two thirds is one and a third.
Right. You know. Yeah. We'll work.
Find
from
the common denominator.
It's three. We'll work from there. Yeah. That person missed that day.
There are a lot of people out there who see the problem with the job, socially, relationship, fail. It's her, it's him, it's them, it's that guy, it's the cops. Well, Fred, who's the common denominator here? Well, that's kind of, it's kind of the only thing that actually matters. So,
it's not you.
They talked about, they released the ballots, all public ballots, and they were discussing Jeter mentioned on 396 of 397. And, you know, it's interesting. I didn't realize this, but 9 years ago, the Baseball Writers Association decided they should be made public, but the Hall of Fame's board of directors overruled them and said, it should be an option for each voter to decide whether to release the ballot. That's interesting because, you know, obviously the ballots that matter, you know, how we elect our politicians, our officials, our leaders, our lawmakers. I mean, that is like treasured secrecy. So should it really matter? And by the way, I didn't realize about 20% of the ballots remain anonymous. So isn't kind of that why you participate in sports as a player, a coach, a manager, a media member, or a journalist? Because isn't that the fun? Taking your stance and then debating it and realizing it's not life and death and that it's, you know, whether Jeter got in on every ballot or everyone but one, he's still forever. I mean, he's not going to get introduced as Derek Jeter, almost, he's going to be Derek Jeter, first ballot Hall of Famer, and then they're going to list his credentials. It's not going to impact how history sees him at all. So I guess that's what I don't get. All right, 284-8571, the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. What do you say we take a break? We'll come back. We'll have an update and move it along with more crunch time. 95-3, the score.
Crunch time on 95.3 The Score is brought to you by Guarantee RV Supercenters. Family owned and operated for more than 50 years. Visit them online at guarantee.com.
So many people have used UConn as a barometer, where they're at. What does this tell you about where your team is at?
I think we should be the barometer. Obviously, there's a lot of room for us to grow and continue to get better, and we didn't have our A game tonight as well. Too many turnovers, and I take a huge, huge role in that because I had a lot of turnovers as well.
Sabrina talking with the sports siren, Holly Rowe, after the game, after the Ducks beat UConn by 18. And, you know, Sabrina, for her, had a great all-around game. She struggled a little bit with her shot. making just 4 field goals, 1 of 3 from the field. He even missed a foul shot. But Sabali, and of course, the night belonged, if you ask me, to Hebert. I mean, from the opening gun, she was like, climb on board. We are not going to be denied tonight. Ruthie Hebert, just an unyielding effort. In speaking with Coach Graves and Bev Smith, just her 94 feet, her rim to rim, the way she just gets up and down the court, plugs the middle, battles the bigs, and now just such a key cog defensively, popping out. And of course, the nearly inimitable way that she and Ionescu are on the same page, working that pick and roll to perfection. And there were times where UConn, if they made a shot, might start a run, but 5 offensive rebounds from Sabali, and I think I remember 3 of them latter part of the third, fourth quarter, just to keep Oregon offensive possessions alive. And 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there, and all of a sudden you got to a point where it's like, they're up 16 points, there's 4 minutes to go, this game is over. This is a butt-whipping. And the physical aspect of her game has been like element 13 now that she's added to the arsenal since she joined the program. And EB, Erin Boley, when she's making shots and the defense has to account for her, just the open space is amazing. Taylor Chavez, who played about half the game, she just couldn't get one to fall. She got some good shots. She missed all 5, missed her 3-pointers. But, I mean, she's been shooting really well in recent games, and she's got to take those shots and make a couple if they're to recognize their dream. And just the bottom line is right now they are in such good shape for, a chance to win the conference, be a 1 seed, and get cited at Portland, because you saw what that meant last year. I mean, no contest the 2 games here, that puts you into Sweet 16, then your 2 wins from New Orleans, and the reason Sabrina came back. Right now, I don't think it's that far off to think, and we'll talk with Michelle Vopel and of ESPN, and I was listening to Maria Taylor last night and doing some follow-up. I mean, as far as next year's draft goes, if Sabali leaves, Oregon may have like 3 of the top 6. I mean, I'm going to seriously consider getting some New York Liberty gear if Ionescu ends up another number 1.
I mean, it would be very Knicks of the Liberty to not take her number 1. Like, she seems like the most obvious number 1, kind of like Zion was this year's men's draft. Like, you would be... I think I saw a couple tweets yesterday during the game where people are like, yes, Sabrina is extremely talented and she's very good, probably going to go number one overall, but like Sabali might have the long-term, like, higher upside as a player or whatever, but like, you'd kind of be a crazy person to not take Sabrina at this point.
Yeah, I don't think this will be an overthink. And I was reading about the roster. They scream for a guard who could run the offense. By the way, whoever just texted me about the performance of Mignon Moore last night, I mean, she was a jolt. I mean, in her 35 minutes, yeah, she scored 12 points. And she handed out 6 dimes. She had a couple of steals. She actually blocked a shot from the backside. And, she's the speed that can neutralize some of these teams when you get to play a South Carolina or a UConn or a UCLA, that, you know, she can keep them in check, and her contribution doesn't necessarily reveal itself on the stat sheet. But if you ask me, the most important player last night was Hebert. She was spectacular. Nelson Adoda, the big for UConn, and she's when I talk with Michelle Volpe, I'm going to ask her about where Ruthie rates among some of the top bigs in the country. 284-8571, the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. You know, when I was watching Ionescu on Van Pelt, and you could be a fan of a team, of a program, of a franchise, and they're not all equal. I would say there's a natural connection between your favorite Duck teams, your favorite, whether you're a Packer fan or a Laker fan or, you know, New York fan like me. And I would assume most of your all-time favorite teams ended up winning a championship or at least playing for one. But there's something that connects. And dare I say, they take a piece of your sports heart. And we've talked about it before. This community has fully embraced this particular team. You know, you go back far enough like I do. The first team that I had that connection with, that you looked at the players and you and your buddies and your family members, and, you know, if you were lucky like me to go to a bunch of games at Madison Square Garden, you know, we referred to them by their first name, their nicknames, and they were a part of us, those championship Nick teams. I mean, they won it when I was 9. They got to the finals when I was 11, and they won it again when I was 12. I mean, I went to so many games. We lived in Jersey, about, I don't know, between, when you consider Lincoln Tunnel traffic and parking from our front porch to the Garden, probably 40 minutes or so. And many times went with my mom and dad, my dad and cousins, dad and friends, mom, dad and friends, you know, whoever was using their tickets. And it was fun to share that. And Saturday nights at Madison Square Garden in the early 70s was when it earned the name that I don't think is warranted anymore, when they called it the Mecca of basketball in the world. New York City was the epicenter. You know, I saw the Miracle Mets in 1969. We were more Yankee fans. Some good Rangers teams. As a more grown-up adolescent, the first Yankee team that really got to me were the Reggie Jackson teams. You know, we went to a bunch of games, World Series. And it was also the first time I was venturing out on my own, that I didn't have to have dad get me tickets or take me to a game. You know, we sat in the bleachers. In game 6, we were in the upper deck in right field. Then the Islander dynasty that saw them win 4 consecutive Stanley Cups from 1980 on. It was 3 months after Team USA had won the gold at Lake Placid. They were special. I think you could make a case that they were as good top to bottom, flawless in all aspects, as any team in NHL history. They made the finals 5 straight years. They did something that I don't think will ever be touched again. They won 19 straight playoff series. Think about that. They had the greatest goal scorer ever in Mike Bossy, the only player ever to score 50 goals every year out of the gate until he hurt his back, had to retire at 30. But played 10 years, scored 36 goals his last year, still scored 550 goals. Loaded with Hall of Famers. I mean, we love them so much. They practiced and played far away. in Westchester County at the Rye Playland is where they practice at Nassau Coliseum. We got credentialed in college radio to go watch that Islander team practice. That's how much a few of us love that team. The 86 Giants, growing up, our generation had only known bad Giants teams. They were awful through the 70s, hired Parcells, lost in 84 to the great Niner team, lost in 85 to the Bears, and then they won it. They finally beat the SOB Cowboys that year at the Meadowlands, and that sent the Cowboys into the tailspin that would lead to the dismissal of Tom Landry and the purchase of the team by Jerry Jones. But, I went to 4 or 5 home games that year. I saw grown men cry when the Giants won. That was one of those things where, obviously, it didn't have the longevity of the Cubs or the Red Sox, which went 86 years, 108 years. But the Giants hadn't won since the 50s. They won in the 80s. They had relocated from Yankee Stadium to Jersey. And then, I moved here in 1990, and there have been a lot of Oregon teams. The Rose Bowl of 94 was special, just not a favorite team of mine. The 98 team, the 95 team, the first year we had season's tickets following 94, Bilotti's first year, that'll always have a warmer spot in my heart. 2010 team, seeing an unbeaten Duck team play for the national title. I think a lot of people will always hold this 2019 edition near and dear, considering the slippage of 2016. Then, 2017, have a coach bolt after a year, the hiring of Cristobal, who wins 9 games his first year, then the division conference championship game in a Rose Bowl. And this team, like I'm saying, of my 50 years, this Oregon women's team is they're on that list. I look forward to their games. They're joyful, and they make doing all this or being a sports fan or the time you spend you value it, you treasure it, you look forward to it, and it's a total feel-good story. All right, 284-8571, the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. Let's bring in Steven. Steven, good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, Steve Cannon. What do you think about the Oregon Ducks? When March Madness comes up this year, do you think they can win? And another thing is, I want to tell you, buddy, the Paralympics for track and field, I might be joining their program as a disabled person this year.
All right. Well, good luck with that. And I'm going to assume that's a two-part question, since it looks like both the men and women will be a part of March Madness. I'll tell you what. If Oregon doesn't end up in the Final Four, the women, I'll be surprised, not shocked, like, oh my God, this is the worst thing ever, but they're going to get 2 home games. They're going to make the Sweet 16. I think they're going to end up sighted at Moda. The chances of a 15th, 17th, 18th, 14th best team in the country beating them, if healthy, especially now that they're healing, you never know. You have one of those days where you can't throw it in the ocean and the other team's just raining threes, but this team is constructed for New Orleans. And the men, I mean, the conference, there's a lot of, best way to put it, availability. There's a run in there. There's a better Oregon team than last year, and they made the Sweet 16. So why not think that they can make a deep run? I mean, could they shoot the ball worse than they just did against Stanford on the road at a hellhole where they always screw up? Maybe that's a bad gauntlet to throw down. So, yeah, a lot of reasons to brim with optimism. All right, let's take a break. We'll be back. Oh, yeah, Tuesday, crunch time, final segment of the program in the first hour, which means...
What are you doing?
Next, 95.3 The Score.
T
Today's show is brought to you by the Coors Light Frost Brewed Sports Desk. Coors Light is the official sponsor of your Oregon Ducks and the Coors Light Refreshing Tweet of the Day. Tweet Steve at SportsTalk953 for your chance to get involved. Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
I'm struggling with Herbert. Players wanted to be around him. The two-minute drill that he ran on Thursday, you could just, he's got something to him. But then I study the tape, and as much as I love the size and the arm strength and the mobility and all those things, I just, you know, Herbert's difficult because he's an introvert. He's a different kind of cat. I don't know that he's going to walk into a locker room and kind of and carry the room.
That's Todd Cliche of ESPN. On his evaluation of Justin Herbert. Where did we see them? Where did we see him on one mock draft? Was it the Colts?
It was, yeah, on the 13? On the telly.
On the telly? I think it was, tell you what, for his sake, 13 to the Colts over 1 to the Bengals all day. Sorry. I mean, the money, few extra bucks, but if he's going to be a great player, the money by the time he's up for a second contract is going to be like $50 million a year if he's a really good NFL quarterback. All right.
Or if he's not, it might still be $50 million a year. Who
yeah,
knows?
Right, if he's a backup. all right, it's that time. I'll lock up the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. The proverbial question for the ages, emojis come to life, a light is shine on knuckleheads. It's called, what are you doing? Nick, why don't you bat first?
To Tommaso Berni, I ask.
What are you doing?
I realize everybody doesn't follow Italian soccer all that much, so here's some background on Mr. Berni. He has made 107 starts in his 15-year professional career. He has not started or played a single minute of actual soccer in Italy's Serie A since 2012. That is 13 or in 6 years since 2012. He hasn't played soccer in 6 years. He signed for Inter Milan in the summer of 2014 as a backup goalie. He has yet to play, which it's kind of already rare for goalies to get brought in as a substitute if there was a weird injury, but literally hasn't been called to play at any level in any sort of secondary cup game and anything that meant anything. He hasn't played in 6 years. This is a job that I absolutely want. I wasn't able to see how much he's been paid to be a second or third string goalie, but that's what makes it a dream job. Anyways, Inter Milan were playing Cagliari last week, and they drew 1-1, and because it's Italy, there was a controversial sending off at the end of the game, and the Inter team were not happy about it. According to reports, most of the players and coaches on the bench rushed the official to tell him how bad he was, and this is where Berni shined. He ran off the bench and ironically applauded the ref at how good of a job he had done, and Berni got a red card. A goalie who hasn't played a single minute of soccer got a red card in a game he wasn't playing in after it ended. I didn't even know that was a thing that could happen, and the idea that his sarcasm was so strong and over the top, it got him suspended from a game he wasn't going to play in anyways. I'm going to have to get me a Tommaso Berni jersey now, as I ask.
What are you doing?
Come with a red card. You know, I've eluded this guy in this segment forever, but to Tom Brady, I ask.
What are you doing?
I've never had a big feel one way or another for Brady. Defended him during Deflategate because difference between being Brady or Brian Hoyer is not the amount of air in the ball. His whole TB12 with avocado ice cream and personal entourage. It's his body, his livelihood, his business. Any role in the Patriots benefiting illegally from those recordings, his name never surfaces. And now this whole thing with the cryptic photo before the Super Bowl, then the ad during the Super Bowl for Hulu, his wife Giselle whining after the Giants beat him again, that my husband can't catch it and throw it. It all adds up to one thing. Tom Brady is annoying. He's not a bad person. He's got a dream life. He's in the GOAT conversation, but for the first time now, I find him pretentious and annoying, and now take extra pleasure in the two times the Giants beat them in the Super Bowl. It's joyous, as we ask.
What are you doing?
To Michigan State, I ask.
What are you doing?
Mark D'Antonio announced his retirement today. He's played there for coached there for 13 years, 6 seasons with more than 10 wins, won a Rose Bowl, had that college football playoff appearance. It's all well and good, but his retirement comes as a shock to me because it's the day before signing day. that's kind of an important day to need your head coach. And yeah, their class is only 10th in the Big 12 with 14 teams, but you're going to let him walk the day before? I mean, you're okay with having a starting a coaching search, hoping to keep your bottom half of the Big 12 recruiting class, and then you've got to pay him $4.3 million because of some contract loophole where he stuck around for almost a month longer than he needed to? I mean, he gets his whole year's salary on January 16th just by still being coached the day before on January 15th, and you're just kind of going to let him walk away? Really? You didn't want to talk to him a month ago to be like, hey, Mark, are you going to stick around? We should probably look for a coach if we wanted to. Now would be the good time to do that instead of, you know, a month from now. Just what exactly is going on? Like, he allegedly made his decision last week, so you've got a week to get ahead of this, but you're just kind of letting it happen? What's the plan here? I really don't get it, as I literally ask.
What are you doing?
Next up, anonymous Hall of Fame voter, I ask.
What are you doing?
I said after the vote was released that my guy Jeter was nearly voted unanimously into Cooperstown. It didn't matter. Time would provide a delete button to the writer who left him out. History's only going to recall the five titles, the magic moments, and degree of excellence he carried to the field daily as one of the greatest pinstripers ever. No scandals, no drugs, issues with women, nothing. He's eternally the captain, lock first ballot Hall of Famer. But now this punk who didn't vote for Jeets has chosen to remain unknown. And I'm like, really? 2020? In this business, you're supposed to live to debate. State your case, defend your side, get into Twitter and radio battles, stand in there and take it because by gum, you're right. So whoever it is, and I'll bet it's a guy, is just a gutless coward who got caught trying to be different and failed, as we ask.
What are you doing?
To the guy who fell asleep at the Super Bowl, I ask.
What are you doing?
Right after kickoff on the big game on Sunday, there was a video that was going around Twitter of a man who was dead asleep in his seat at the Super Bowl while the game was happening in the lower bowl. And this guy was either given these tickets worth thousands of dollars and figured, about time I took a nap, or paid thousands of dollars for a ticket to the biggest sporting event on the planet and figured, I'd like to waste my money by now taking a nap. Turns out his name is Declan Kelly. He's an Irish businessman, but no one has seemingly asked him why he took this nap at this time. Real human beings and fans would have paid thousands of dollars to have been there and be awake for the game, and he literally just slept away. And not like a little half sleep or maybe he was kind of drunk and nodding off or whatever. This guy had his head back against the barrier, legs crossed, mouth wide open, sawing logs. My dude, I really hope it wasn't jet lag, and I really hope you didn't pay for those tickets, as I ask.
What are you doing?
And lastly, the New York Knicks, I ask.
What are you doing?
Problem settled. That drought I speak of, no title since 73, that's going to end. They fired Steve Mills, and of course it was all his fault. I mean, he's been on the job for, what the hell's the difference? The team owner, James Dolan, still meddles in personnel decisions, despite the fact he wouldn't know a 2-3 zone from a man-to-man Indiana defense. And now basketball ops are in the hands of Scott Perry. Ooh, sweet. Oh, and Dolan thinks he's going to lure Masai Ujiri away from the Raptors. Dolan's also considering following the Warrior or Laker model and picking a personnel guy from the agent ranks. I bet you that's going to turn out just great, for sure. Sell the team! Sell the team! As we ask.
What are you doing?
James Dolan. I'm going to call him Rose from now on because he is a thorn in my side. But all right. Looking ahead to the 4 o'clock hour, we've got something. Sports Talk, 95.3, The Score.
I'm a fun guy.